a carpenter ex-biker, a zookeeper ex-soldier, two other zookeepers, an electrician, and an erstwhile historian. Four men, two women, two eagles, three falcons, and a goshawk. I swig from a bottle of cider, and this company is suddenly all I ever wished for.
Excuse me, is that a goshawk?
He's in his 40s with glasses, a thick-set, cheerful man holding a wriggling toddler.
Hang on, Tom, he says. We're going to get an ice cream. I just want to talk to this lady for a second.
I grin. I know how it feels to hold on to a creature who wants to be somewhere else, and then my heart falters just a little. No father, no partner, no child, no job, no home.
Get over yourself, Helen, I hiss inwardly.
It's yours, he says.
Wow. I tell him about the goshawk. He listens, then his face turns serious and sad.
You are so lucky, he says. I've always wanted to do falconry, all my life. I've got books and everything, but I've never had the time.
There's a pause.
Maybe one day.
He hugs Tom a little closer.
Come on then, you, he says, and they walk away to the ice cream van.
White air and aching bones. Another migraine. I swallow a dose of codeine and paracetamol. My head still hurts. There's a broomer's pewter light outside as if someone had stuck tracing paper against the glass. I go back to bed. Must fly goshawk, I think when I wake. Must fly goshawk. But I'm finding it so hard to move that secretly I'm hoping the hawk's weight is wrong, or the weather is. I have no excuse to stay in bed this time. Both hawk and weather are fine. We drive into a strange, windless, sunny afternoon that makes everything resemble hollow metal models painted with enamel. Clouds, swags of leaves, houses, all in the same plane, like a stage set and riveted together. The air smells of wood smoke. I am inexpressibly tired. I park the car on the grassy verge near the field, change Mabel's dresses, unhood her, and she snaps into Yarrick in an instant. She knows where she is. And here we are. And there are the rabbits. She leaves the fist. As soon as she does, the pain in my head recedes and my exhaustion fades. Her flight is getting much more stylish. I'm still astonished by how fast she is. When I watch her scaly, foreshortened, hunched flight away from me towards a distant target, I swear that the world around her slows. She seems to be moving at precisely the right speed, and everything around her, rabbits running, leaves falling, a pigeon flying overhead, all these things slow down, as if they're moving through liquid. I am becoming fascinated by her quality of attention. I'm starting to believe in what Barry Lopez has called the conversation of death, something he saw in the exchange of glances between caribou and hunting wolves, a wordless negotiation that ends up with them working out whether they will become hunter and hunted or passers-by. I'm wondering whether my goshawk does this. Mabel back on the fist, I walk towards three rabbits. They're sitting on the grass, right there, no more than 10 yards away. Closer. 5 yards. Mabel is enraging Yarrick, but is ignoring them. She's staring with interest at the other end of the field, something out there, a good 6 or 7 seconds flight away.
Mabel, I murmur, look.
And I try to angle my hand so her head turns towards the rabbits underneath her nose. One of them hops about.
It's just there.
She still ignores it. I don't understand. She cranes her neck to the other end of the field again, and then my fist is empty. She's gone, flying to the far side of the field, very low, very fast, dancing about the tops of the short nettles, missing one rabbit,
making split-second calculations and attention switches, then crashing down on another. These are the rabbits she has been conversing with. I run towards the spot. I can't see her anywhere. Where is she? There are nettles everywhere, but it's only regrowth, a mere 3 inches high. Where is my hawk? I hold my breath. Silence. And then I hear muffled, muffled bells. And finally, I spot her head snaking up out of the nettles. What the? She looks like she's broken, crushed, as if gravity had suddenly increased tenfold. Her wings fanned, feathers bent upwards along their veins from the pressure. Oh, I see it now. Her wings are spread to brace herself against the ground, because she has hold of the rabbit, and the rabbit is down the hole, and she's holding on and bracing with all her might to stop herself being pulled underground. Her beak is open with the effort. I reach down the hole, feel my way along her impossibly long shins, and encounter a rabbit foot. She has it, but only just. I grab the leg and try to work out how to extract the rabbit from the hole. I pull a little and the rabbit kicks. Goshawk squeaks. I change the angle and slowly, like an evil rural conjurer, pull the rabbit out of the hole and toss it onto the grass. Mabel stamps and dances, changes her hold from hind leg to head, and the rabbit is still. She is in such a rage that she stamps up and down on the rabbit for ages once it's dead, and then starts plucking it. She plucks for minutes, and soon we are surrounded by a deep circle of soft grey fur. The conversation of death. The sentence kept coming to mind. I'd think of it at odd moments, while taking a bath, scratching my nose, leaning to grab a mug of hot tea. My subconscious was trying to tell me something, and though it was shouting very loudly indeed, I didn't hear what it was saying. Things were going wrong, very wrong. One afternoon, Mabel leapt up from her perch to my fist, lashed out with one foot, and buried 4 talons in my bare right arm. I froze. Blood was dripping onto the kitchen floor. I could do nothing. Her grip was too powerful. I had to wait until she decided to let go. The pressure was immense, but the pain, though agonizing, was happening to someone else. Why has she footed me? I thought wildly, after she released her grip and continued as if nothing had happened at all. She'd never been aggressive before. I was sure I'd done nothing to provoke her. Is she overkeen? Is the weighing machine broken? I spent a good quarter of an hour fussing about with piles of tuppences trying to calibrate it. There was nothing wrong with it at all. But something was wrong with me. It wasn't just a hawk-inflicted injury. I was becoming vastly anxious. I jumped in panic when the postman knocked on the door, recoiled from the ringing phone. I stopped seeing people, cancelled my gallery talk, deadlocked the front door. Out on the hill, I fled from walkers, dodged behind hedges when farm vehicles drove up the track. Some days I lay in bed in so much mysterious pain, I began to believe the only explanation was a terminal disease. You could explain what it was like by running to books and papers. You could read Freud. You could read Klein. You could read any number of theories about attachment and loss and grief. But those kinds of explanations come from a world the hawk wasn't in. They aren't any help. They are like explaining how it feels to be in love by waving an MRI scan of a love-struck brain. You have to look in different places. The anthropologist Rain Villeslev once lived for a year in a Yukaga community in northeastern Siberia and became fascinated by how their hunters saw the relationship between humans and animals. The hunters, he wrote, think humans and animals can turn into each other by temporarily taking on one another's bodies. If you want to hunt elk, you dress in elk skins, walk like an elk, take on an elk's alien consciousness. If you do this, elk will recognize you as one of their own and walk towards you. But, Villeneuve explained, Yukaghi hunters consider these transformations very dangerous, because they can make you lose sight of your original species identity and undergo an invisible metamorphosis. Turning into an animal can imperil the human soul. Villeneuve included the story of a hunter who'd been tracking reindeer for many hours and ended up in an unfamiliar camp, where women he did not know gave him lichen to eat, and he started forgetting things. He remembered his wife, but could not remember her name. Confused, he fell asleep, and it was only when he dreamed he was surrounded by reindeer urging him to leave that he saw what he had done. That story made me shiver when I read it, because that was what it was like. I'd turned myself into a hawk, taken all the traits of goshawks in the books and made them my own. I was nervous, highly strung, paranoid, prone to fits of terror and rage. I ate greedily, or didn't eat at all. I fled from society, hid from everything, found myself drifting to strange states where I wasn't certain who or what I was. In hunting with Mabel day after day, I had assumed, in my imagination, of course, but that was all it could ever be, her alien perspective, her inhuman understanding of the world. It brought something akin to madness, and I did not understand what I had done. When I was small, I'd thought turning into a hawk would be a magical thing. What I'd read in The Sword in the Stone encouraged me to think it, too, as a good and instructive thing, a lesson in life for the child who would be king. But now, the lesson was killing me. It was not at all the same. 2 days before the service, something very strange happened on the hill. We'd been walking up a hedgerow running down the edge of a field of undersown stubble. There was a pheasant in the hedge. I'd heard it cluck and run rat-wise along the damp and nettly ditch, and Mabel had heard it too. She'd crashed over the hedge and perched out of sight at the top, facing away from me. Her blood was up, and mine too. I shouldered my way into the hedge, knowing that any second now the pheasant would rocket out in front of me in a burnished clatter of feathers. I pushed my head through the hedge, heard a whoosh of air, and felt a staggering blow. I reeled, coshed by a goshawk. First, only blackness, then a field of stars, and then a weird proprioceptive sense that I was wearing a crown of thorns, a complicated halo of pain around my head. She'd bounced off me, left 8 talon incisions behind, and was back at the top of the tree, craning to see the pheasant, which had done what all pheasants do best, escape. I shook my head, dully. She thought I was the pheasant. She didn't know it was me. A strange buzzing in my ears, and then a muffled calm as the endorphins kicked in. I held my hand out and whistled her down to my fist, then mechanically started working the rest of the hedge line. We were walking into the sun at this point, and I started taking a warm, distinct pleasure in the fuzzy gold aura that bathed us. Light-headed, slightly unsure of my footing, I finally wondered, why is my vision strange and why do my eyes sting? Then, why is the goshawk baiting at my face? It took me a while to work out why both. I rubbed my eyes and my hand came away soaked dramatically and Shakespeareanly in blood. I pulled off my glasses. They were covered in it. Blood was running in streams down my forehead, into my left eye, and was now attracting the attention of a hungry goshawk. Christ, I thought, this is a bit Edgar Allan Poe. I used my sleeve and some wet grass to get the worst off. Luckily, this was sufficient to make the goshawk uninterested in eating me. I felt for the talon incision, a half-inch long, deep slash right between my eyes. Ah, yes, the sixth chakra, the seat of concealed wisdom, now rouged with an Ostringer's bindi. I pressed the place hard with my fingers until it stopped bleeding. And then I kept on hawking, stumbling across the fields in a haze of pained euphoria. The sun had descended behind sheets of cenarial stratus to become a luminous disk glowing through talc-filled air, and it was exactly the same color as Mabel's eye. I held her up, comparing sun with goshawk eye, and marveled at their correspondence. By the time we'd reached the top of the hill, my legs rebelled. "Enough," they said. "Enough walking. Sit down. Have a nap." So I sat in the stubble, woozily glorying at the beauty of it all, the mist rising in the hollows, flocks of golden plover pouring over in sheaves, the way the bluish new rapeseed leaves contrasted with the vertical straw of the stubble at my feet, the glow of the lost sun beneath the ridge, crickets beginning to sing, rooks on their way to roost passing over us in moving constellations of small black stars. And perhaps that cosh to the head had knocked some human sense back into me, because when I got home, I sat on the sofa and wrote my father's eulogy, straight out in 20 minutes, with a small round plaster stuck on my injured forehead. Chapter 23. Memorial. I sat on the train clutching the folder with the speech inside, ankles burning from the heater on the floor. Outside, winter breathed in. Papery skies, glittering trees, a wash of backlit fields that folded and shrank as the city grew. Then I was at the church, folder in hand, staring at hundreds of feet on the black and white floor, hundreds of shoulders and ties and points of collars, hems of skirts, clicks and echoes of tiny black heels. I worried I hadn't dressed smartly enough. I was wearing a black cotton dress from Debenhams. Maybe it was the wrong thing? Why hadn't I gone and bought a proper outfit? Something expensive and smart and sharp around the edges. It took a few seconds before it struck me that my panic might not be about clothes at all. I sat down in the stalls between my mother and my brother, took their hands, light-headed with love and sorrow. My aunt was here, my brother's partner and her parents too. We were a family. We were. I looked around for the other speakers, Ron Morgans and Alistair Campbell, who'd worked with Dad for years, and Jeremy Selwyn, another photographer, biting his lip and watching the crowds pour in. I walked up to the lectern with the paper in my hand. I'd given so many lectures, so many talks, that I thought this would be easy. But it was not. I was terrified. I grabbed the lectern's wooden edges to stop me from swaying. "How can I do this?" "Don't look at the audience," said a voice inside me. "Pretend they're not there." And then another voice inside said, "Look at the audience." I looked. Hundreds of faces. Dad's colleagues. Dad's friends. The fear vanished in an instant. I couldn't be scared any more. And I started speaking. I told them about my father. I told them a little about his early life. I told them he had been a wonderful father. I remembered them, too, of his ridiculous inability to wear anything other than a suit, although he did make concessions on holiday and occasionally removed his tie. I told them that on our trip to Cornwall to photograph the total eclipse, we'd been standing on the beach before the skies darkened, when a man who said he was the reincarnation of King Arthur, a man wearing a silver diadem and long white robes, came up to Dad and said, bewildered, "Why are you wearing that suit?" "Well," said Dad, "you never know who you're going to meet." And then I told the story I hoped They would understand. He's a boy, standing by a fence and staring up at the sky. He's at an aerodrome, big in hills, spotting RAF planes. He is 9, 10. He's been photographing each aircraft that takes off or lands with the box brownie camera that hangs on a string around his neck and putting their numbers down in a spiral-bound notebook. It is getting late. He ought to leave. Then he hears a sound he cannot place, an unfamiliar engine note. And yes, there, this is it. This is the moment he has dreamed of. He stares into the sky. He sees the landing lights of... He doesn't know what it is. He doesn't know what it is. It is not in any of the books. He takes its picture. He copies its registration number onto the page. It is a visitation from the future, a new American Air Force plane. To the boy plane spotter of the 1950s, it is like seeing the Holy Grail. When I was writing the speech, still a little concussed, I reach for the phone to call my father and ask what type of plane it was, and for a moment the world went very black. A hand fell on his shoulder and a voice said, "Come with me, laddie." They frog-marched him to the guardhouse, pushed him through the door, and there behind a desk, a sergeant major type with a moustache and a frown stood up, barked at him, ripped the page out of his notebook, screwed it into a ball and threw it in the bin, shouted some more, took the back off the camera, exposed the roll of film, pulled it out in loops of falling acetate, and dumped that in the bin too. "I was crying my eyes out," Dad said. They said, "Go home. You didn't see anything. Forget you were here." And they dumped me back at the perimeter, and I stood there with my notebook and the brownies sobbing away. But then I stopped crying because I thought of something. Something out of Dick Barton, or The Eagle. Maybe I'd written hard enough. Using his pencil, he shaded the page of his notebook with graphite. And there, white on grey, impressed on the paper from the missing page above, was the registration number of the secret plane. He stopped crying, he said, and cycled home in triumph. I sat down, dazed, sun through windows, things, one after another, the achingly beautiful singing of the choir, the canon's prayers, eulogies praising my father's photographic skills. When Alistair Campbell walked to the lectern, he read Wordsworth's Composed Upon Westminster Bridge, and prefaced it with a short speech in which he said, with decided emphasis, that my father was a good man. This broke me. I hadn't expected this, or not this much this. Everyone sang Jerusalem, and I forced my mouth to move, but nothing came out but whispered fragments. And afterwards, out in the shaded churchyard under the trees, a young guy with misted glasses and a purple knitted cardigan walked up, shying nervously, and said, "You don't know me. I don't know anyone in there. They're all the big guns. But I wanted to say that, well, I'm a photographer now. I'm making a living out of it. I moved to London to try and make it, and I didn't know what I was doing. And I met your dad out on a job once, and he talked to me. He gave me loads of advice. He helped me. He didn't have to, but he did. He saved my life. He was amazing." And he tailed off and looked embarrassed. And I stepped forward and gave him a hug, because I didn't know what to say. And more people came up and talked about Dad. And all the old guard were there, snappers from back in the 1960s, and I finally got to put names to the bylines I'd seen so many times. They told me they liked the story. They said it was nice to know that my father was a born journalist, that the boy in short trousers was already the man they'd known, the man who'd always got the picture, had always pulled the story from the jaws of defeat. Down in the press club after the service, the drinks were poured, and poured, and poured some more. Everyone became increasingly expansive, rushed up to tell me stories about my father. The stories got more slurred as the drinking went on and the hugs and cheek kisses increasingly off target. "Another drink?" said one pressman. "Just a soft drink," I said, and Becky came with a vast glass of wine. "Is there any soft drink?" I said, embarrassed. He frowned. "That's what I brought you. It is a soft drink." I left with a song in my heart. I felt my family had expanded by about 200 people, and everything was going to be fine. "Bless you, Dad," I thought. "I'd always thought you were a legend, and it turns out you really, really were." All the way home on the train, I thought of Dad and the terrible mistake I'd made. I'd thought that to heal my great hurt, I should flee to the wild. It was what people did. The nature books I'd read told me so. So many of them had been quests inspired by grief or sadness. Some had fixed themselves to the stars of elusive animals. Some sought snow geese. Others snow leopards. Others cleaved to the earth, walked trails, mountains, coasts and glens. Some sought wildness at a distance. Others closer to home. Nature in her green, tranquil woods heals and soothes all afflictions, wrote John Muir. Earth hath no sorrows that earth cannot heal. Now I knew this for what it was, a beguiling but dangerous lie. I was furious with myself and my own unconscious certainty that this was the cure I needed. Hands are for other human hands to hold. They should not be reserved exclusively as perches for hawks. And the wild is not a panacea for the human soul. Too much in the air can corrode it to nothing. And by the time I'd got home, I'd worked out, too, why Mabel had been behaving so strangely. She'd grown heavy with muscle over our weeks on the hill, and though she was flying at a higher weight than before, over this last week, she'd got too low. She was hungry. Hunger had made her aggressive. I was furious with myself when I realized that first great error on the train, but this second realization brought self-hatred. I'd been so blind, so miserable. I'd not seen my hawk was miserable too. I'd not seen her at all. I remembered the man I'd fallen for after my father died. I'd hardly known him, but it didn't matter. I'd recruited him to serve my loss, made him everything I needed. No wonder he had run away. And now I'd made the same mistake again. I'd fled to become a hawk, but in my misery, all I had done was turn the hawk into a mirror of me. The next evening, weak with relief and the sense that something huge, something tectonic had shifted in my world, I gave Mabel a whole dead pigeon to eat in the grey, cool evening. We sat on a chair under the apple tree, listening to blackbirds chinking in the hedge. The house didn't seem unfriendly anymore. The kitchen window threw a soft square of light into the garden. Huge, frosty piles of pigeon feathers accumulated on the lawn. And then she ate every last scrap. When it was finished, her crop was so full she could hardly stand. With the plucking of the pigeon came more revelations, as if with its uncovering other things were uncovered. I thought of the dreams I'd had that spring of the hawk slipping away into air. I'd wanted to follow it, fly with it, and disappear. I had thought for a long while that I was the hawk. One of those sulky goshawks able to vanish into another world, sitting high in the winter trees. But I was not the hawk. No matter how much I pared myself away, no matter how many times I lost myself in blood and leaves and fields, I was the figure standing underneath the tree at nightfall, collar upturned against the damp, waiting patiently for the hawk to return. Mabel was cutting through the crisp ribcage of the pigeon now. She was pulling at the thin intercostal membrane. Snap. I thought of my father shading a pencil over ghostly impressions on the page. Snap. I thought of White and the reasons why his book had haunted me all this time. Snap. Another breaking rib. It wasn't just that I saw in his book, reflected backwards and dimly, my own retreat into wildness. It was this. Of all the books I read as a child, his was the only one I remembered where the animal didn't die. Goss never died. He was only lost. For all White's certainty that his hawk was dead, there was always a chance, even to the very end of the book, even further, that the hawk might return. In the childish depths of my mind, the hawk was out there, still in the wood, his yellow toes clutching rough bark and his pale eyes watching me from a dark tangle of branches, somewhere in the multitudinous sea of 100,000 trees. Melanie Klein wrote that children go through states of mind comparable to mourning, and that this early mourning is revived whenever grief is experienced in later life. She thought that adults try to manage newer losses the way they managed older ones. I thought of that drawing of a kestrel, its carefully worked jesses penciled over and over again by my 6-year-old hand, with all its desperate insistence on the safety of knots and lines. Goss was still out there in the dark forest to which all things lost must go. I'd wanted to slip across the borders of this world into that wood and bring back the hawk White lost. Some part of me that was very small and old had known this. Some part of me that didn't work according to the everyday rules of the world, but with the logic of myths and dreams. And that part of me had hoped, too, that somewhere in that other world was my father. His death had been so sudden. There had been no time to prepare for it, no sense in it happening at all. He could only be lost. He was out there, still, somewhere out there in that tangled wood with all the rest of the lost and dead. I know now what those dreams in spring had meant, the ones of a hawk slipping through a rent in the air into another world. I'd wanted to fly with the hawk to find my father. Find him and bring him home. Chapter 24. Drugs. Sometimes when light dawns, it simply illuminates how dismal circumstances have become. Every morning I wake at 5 and have 30 seconds lead time before despair crashes in. I don't dream of my father anymore. I don't dream of people at all. I walk over winter sand flats past storm pools of fog-reflecting water packed with migrant birds stranded by the weather, unable to fly south for winter. Sometimes I dream I'm climbing trees that crack and fall, or sailing tiny boats that overturn in frozen seas. They are pathetic dreams. I don't need an analyst to explain them. I know now that I'm not trusting anyone or anything anymore, and that it is hard to live for long periods without trusting anyone or anything. It's like living without sleep. Eventually it will kill you. I have spent my evenings playing with Mabel. I've made her toys out of paper and tissue and card. She turns her head upside down, puffs out her chin feathers, squeaks, picks up the toys in her beak, drops them and preens. When I throw her balls of scrunched-up paper, she catches them in her beak and tosses them back to me with a flick of her head. Then she crouches, waiting for me to throw them to her again. It is as good as it gets. When I told Stuart I played catch with her, for a while he didn't believe me. You don't play with goshawks. It's not what people do. But I have had to somehow leaven the chill. Because other people with goshawks have people too. For them, their goshawks are their little splinter of wildness, their balance to domesticity. Out in the woods with the hawk, Other falconers get in touch with their solitudinous, bloody souls. But then they come home and have dinner, watch TV, play with their kids, sleep with their partner, wake, make tea, go to work. You need both sides, as they say. I don't have both sides. I only have wildness, and I don't need wildness anymore. I'm not stifled by domesticity. I have none. There is no need right now to feel close to a fetch of dark northern woods, a creature with baleful eyes and death in her foot. Human hands are for holding other hands. Human arms are for holding other humans close. They're not for breaking the necks of rabbits, pulling loops of viscera out onto leaf litter while the hawk dips her head to drink blood from her quarry's chest cavity. I watch all these things going on, and my heart is salt. Everything is stuck in an eternal present. The rabbit stops breathing. The hawk eats. Leaves fall. Clouds pass overhead. A car drives past the field, and there are people in it, held securely on their way somewhere, wrapped in life like a warm coat. Tire sounds recede. A heron bows overhead. I watch the goshawk snip, tear, and wrench flesh from the rabbit's foreleg. I feel sorry for the rabbit. Rabbit was born, grew up in the field, ate dandelions and grass, scratched his jaw with his feet, hopped about, had baby rabbits of his own. Rabbit didn't know what lonely was. He lived in a warren. And rabbit is now just a carefully packed assemblage of different kinds of food for a hawk who spends her evenings watching television on the living room floor. Everything is so damn mysterious. Another car passes. Faces turn to watch me crouched with rabbit and hawk. I feel like a tableau at a roadside shrine. But I'm not sure what the shrine is for. I'm a roadside phenomenon. I am death to community. I am missing the point. There is a point? White said that training a hawk was like psychoanalysis. He said that training a goshawk was like training a person that was not a human, but a hawk. Now I see that I am more of a rabbit than a hawk. Living with a goshawk is like worshipping an iceberg or an expanse of sliprock chilled by a January wind, the slow spread of that splinter of ice in your eye. I love Mabel, but what passes between us is not human. There is a kind of coldness that allows interrogators to put cloth over the mouths of men and pour water into their lungs and lets them believe this is not torture. What you do to your heart. You stand apart from yourself, as if your soul could be a migrant beast too, standing some way away from the horror and looking fixedly at the sky. The goshawk catches a rabbit. I kill the rabbit. There is no lust for blood in my heart. I have no heart at all. I watch it all as if I was an executioner after a thousand deaths, as if all this was just the inescapable way of the world. I don't think it is. I pray it isn't. I have scared myself. I go to the doctor. I drive to the surgery with no hope of rescue, but I can't think of anything else to do. The doctor is a man I've not seen before, small, dark-haired, with a neat beard, red braces, and a crumpled cotton shirt. He sits behind a wooden desk. "Hello," he says. "Take a seat." I sit on a chair. I look at the desk. It is oak. I think of winter trees. "What seems to be the trouble?" he asks. I say I think I might be depressed. That some things have happened over the last few months. My father died. "I'm so sorry," he says. Then I tell him I have no job anymore and no money coming in and no house either. It doesn't sound convincing. So I tell him more and more. Now it's hard to stop talking, but when I do, he says some words. I can't hear them clearly. I am watching his eyebrows. Sometimes they are frowning, sometimes very high. He hands me a multiple-choice questionnaire. This strikes me as grimly funny. I sit in front of it for a very long while, fiddling with the pen, worrying that I'm not getting the answers right. When it is finished, it is hard to give it back. I'm convinced I've done it wrong. I don't cry. I hand him the piece of paper and he takes it, turns it over, and regards it for a while. He puts it down. He moves a pen from one side of the sheet to the other. He leans across the table. I see his face. I turn away. It is too unbearably kind. "Helen, we can help you," he says in a low voice. "We really can." There's a kind of tingling astonishment when I hear his words. It's something like hope. I start to sob. I sob right through 20 minutes of delicate discussion and agree to try a course of antidepressants. He is a good doctor. He tells me all about SSRIs, talks me through their side effects, their history, their mode of operation. He draws little diagrams of neurons, adds dots and wavy lines for serotonin molecules and the action of reuptake inhibitors. I peer at the pictures, fascinated. An hour later, I'm walking down the street with a white paper bag in my hand. It weighs almost nothing. He says it will make things better, which is ridiculous. How can this grey and mortified world be washed away by little dots and lines? Then I start to worry that the drugs will make me ill. Even more absurdly, I panic that they'll stop me thinking clearly, that they'll stop me flying Mabel, that whoever I'll become under their chemical influence will be so strange and alien, she won't fly to me anymore. The worries are a tedious avalanche, but I put them to one side for long enough to swallow the drugs with water. There is an almost immediate effect, a tiredness so vast I can hardly walk, and my skull is empty, tight and painful. I don't sleep that night. I lie in bed. The next morning, I drink coffee. I drink more coffee. I keep on flying the hawk. Those books about people running to the wild to escape their grief and sorrow were part of a much older story, so old its shape is as unconscious and invisible as breathing. When I was a student, slogging through the first years of my degree, I read a long and beautiful 13th century poem called Sir Orfeo. No one knows who wrote it, and I had forgotten it existed. But one morning, while pulling a handful of chicks out of the freezer, the poem came to mind, turned out of the ground in one of those strange excavations of the disordered mind. Sir Orfeo is a retelling of the Greek myth of Orpheus and the underworld, by way of traditional Celtic songs about the other world, the land of faerie. In Celtic myth, that other world is not deep underground. It is just one step aside from our own. Things can exist in both places at once, and things can be pulled from one to the other. In the poem, Eurydice sleeps in an orchard under a grafted fruit tree, an imp tree, and dreams that the next day she will be stolen away by the king of faerie. Terrified, she tells her husband the king. Orfeo surrounds her with armed knights, but they cannot protect her from this otherworldly threat. She slips through the air and vanishes. Stricken with grief, Orfeo gives up his crown and runs to the forest. For 10 years he lives a solitary, feral existence, digging for roots, eating leaves and berries, playing his harp to charm the beasts around him. His beard grows long and matted. He watches the grand hunting parties of the fairy king pass through the forest. He cannot follow them. But one day, 60 ladies with falcons on their fists ride by, hunting for cormorants, mallards, herons. As he watches the falcons strike down their prey, the world changes. He laughs with delight, remembering his love for the sport. "Parfait," quoth he, "there is fair game." And he walks towards the women and sees among them his wife. He has entered that other world, and now he can follow them back to the castle of the fairy king, a palace full of people that were thought to be dead, but are not. And it is there he plays his harp to the king, and persuades him to release his wife. But it was the hawk's flight, and the deaths they brought, that ushered him into that other world, let him find his wife that was lost. And this ability of hawks to cross borders that humans cannot is a thing far older than Celtic myth, older than Orpheus. For in ancient shamanic traditions right across Eurasia, hawks and falcons were seen as messengers between this world and the next. There's another poem in Latin about a grief-stricken flight to the forest. It was written by Geoffrey of Monmouth, a 12th century cleric best known for his Historia Regum Britanniae, the history of the kings of Britain. The Historia was a hugely influential chronicle, but the other poem, also in Latin, is much less well known. It starts with a great battle in which a Welsh king loses many of his friends. For 3 long days he weeps, strews dust on his hair, refusing food. Grief consumes him. Then a strange madness or new fury comes upon him. He departed secretly and fled to the wood and rejoiced to lie hidden under the ash trees. He marvelled at wild beasts feeding on the grass of the glades. Now he chased after them, and again he flew past them. He lived on the roots of grasses and on the grass, on the fruit of the trees and on the mulberries of the thicket. He became a sylvan man, just as though devoted to the woods. For a whole summer after this, hidden like a wild animal, he remained buried in the woods, found by no one and forgetful of himself and of his kindred. Geoffrey's poem is the Vita Merlini, the life of Merlin. And the feral figure who, in forgetting himself, flew with the birds is Merlin Silvestris, the Merlin of the woods, the prophet and seer who in later tales would be recast as the greatest magician of all, and who in Merlin, in The Sword in the Stone, would educate the king. It's tempting to imagine an originary moment, one perfect opening scene. An autumn evening in 1937, when White takes down a book from the shelves that he does not want to read. It is a small blue book with a cloth cover, the first volume of La Mort d'Arthur, Sir Thomas Malory's 15th century retelling of stories about the legendary king. White had written his dissertation on it at Cambridge, and he is disinclined to return to it now. But he's finished all the other books in the house, so he sits in his armchair and begins to read. It is plodding, slow work, like wading through treacle. He nearly puts it down, but suddenly it catches on him, grips him like Goss had his shoulder with 8 fierce talons, and he is stricken with amazement. This is a proper story, a proper tragedy, he thinks. The people in it are real. They had not been real before. Over 2 days, he reads the whole thing with the passion of an Edgar Wallace fiend, then put it down and took up a pen. It is easy to say, there. That is how The Sword in the Stone began. But I do not think that is the story at all. The book had been started months before, when a round thing that was something like a clothes basket was set down before his door. White thought it a warm-hearted book, quite unlike his previous efforts. "It seems impossible to determine whether it is for grown-ups or children," he wrote to Potts. "It is a preface to Malory." The boy in the book is called the Wart. He is a kindly soul, loyal and slightly stupid. He is an orphan and does not know you'll become king. Sir Ector has raised him along with his natural son. The Wart will never become a knight because he is not a gentleman, but in the book he is given a magical teacher, Merlin, and a magical education too. Eschewing school desks and lessons learned by rote, Merlin turns the Wart into animals and sends him off on quests. As a fish, the boy learns about the dictator's passion for power by meeting the pike in the castle moat. As a snake, he learns of history. He hears the trees speak and sees the birth of the world through the eyes and ears of an owl. He discusses mankind's role in God's plan with a donnish badger in a comfortably furnished set. And at the end, his education complete, the Wart pulls the sword from the stone, learns he is the son of Uther Pendragon, and is crowned King Arthur. It is a glorious dream of wish fulfillment for White. He writes himself into the character of the Wart, the boy of unacknowledged royal blood, who runs wild around the castle, just as he had raced about Westhill House and St. Leonard's-on-Sea, wild and happy and free. White had been torn from safety and sent away to school, but he saves the Wart from such a fate. There would be no beatings in his education. But even so, his lessons are full of cruelty. I did not understand quite how cruel a book it was when I was young, but I responded to that cruelty all the same, because my favourite part of the book was the Wart's ordeal as a hawk. It was truly terrifying. I'd read it and squirm and curl my toes, then read it all over again. Merlin turns the Wart into his namesake, a Merlin, and loses him in the castle mews at night. And as a new officer in the cadre of the castle's trained hawks, the Wart must undergo the customary ordeal. He is ordered to stand next to Colonel Cully, the goshawk, until the rest of the hawks ring their bells three times. It is an exquisitely dangerous initiation, for the colonel is insane. As the ordeal begins, the goshawk glowers and mutters. He quotes broken snatches of Shakespeare and Webster, run all together in a fugue of rising horror. After the bells ring once, the goshawk begs for the test to end, cries, "I can't hold off much longer." The bells ring twice. He moves towards the Wart, stamping the perch convulsively. He was terrified of the Wart, not triumphing, and he must slay. In that awful ordeal, White is the Wart, the boy who must be brave. But he is not just the Wart, and the boy is not the only one imperiled. There's a sad passage in Olivia Lang's book, The Trip to Echo Spring, that reminds me of this desperate scene. She quotes the writer John Cheever, whose alcoholism was intimately bound up with his erotic desires for men. He hated his homosexuality and felt himself in constant danger. "Every comely man, every bank clerk and delivery boy," he wrote in his journals, "was aimed at my life like a loaded pistol." Despite several affairs with women, White's fantasies were sadistic and directed mostly at pubescent boys. He was certain that these fantasies had been shaped by his early abuse, and they shamed and horrified him. For in them, he played the role of the abuser, just like his father and the masters who had beaten him. Therapy with Bennett had not taken these urges away. They never left him. Late in his life, he wrote a pornographic novel about spanking schoolboys. It was a prolonged and awful confession. But he locked it away and never showed it to anyone. All his life, he suppressed his desires. But sometimes, just sometimes, he could speak of them through other selves. Colonel Cully is one of them. A hawk racked with desire to hurt a boy who is also a bird. A boy who is also himself. You can see the whole of his life's tragedy there, in one small scene. Though White had fled from the world of school, he never escaped the models it had given him on how to conduct his life. At school you had to pass tests and ordeals to prove you were brave. You tested your bravery in the playing fields and through the beatings by masters and prefects. And there were the ceremonies of cruelty of the boys themselves, the initiations and ordeals that were the price of entrance into the school and later into boys' secret societies. White had put his hand between the cocked hammer of an unloaded revolver and its frame before the trigger was pulled. The pain was a triumph. In bearing the agony, he proved he could belong. But White was not always the victim in these rituals. School taught him that as he suffered at the hands of older boys, so he should punish the younger. He joined gangs and terrorized those weaker than himself, testing them as he had been tested. One term, the test was to jump from a window in big school 14 feet to the ground. Puppy Mason was too scared to do it, so White assisted in pushing him out. When the fall broke his leg in 3 places, they were impressed by his silence. He told the masters that he had tripped over a twig on the headmaster's garden path. Puppy had been tested, had behaved heroically, and his membership of the fraternity was approved. I knew nothing of such things. I knew about being hurt. The impossibly clumsy child that was me scraped her knees, tripped, grazed herself, hit her head on open windows and bled terribly. But I did not understand the logic behind ordeals of belonging. I did not see pain and bravery as steps towards gaining self-reliance, as necessary parts of growing up. But still I noticed, when I read The Sword in the Stone, that whenever the wart became an animal, he seemed to be in danger. I puzzled over this. Merlin is teaching him to be brave, I thought eventually, because he will need to be brave to be king. I read Colonel Cully's ordeal with the wart over and over again. It mesmerized me because when you are small, you don't have to worry about the child heroes in books. They might suffer peril, but they are human. They never, ever die. But there was always a flicker of worry as I read The Sword in the Stone. For it was not quite clear if the wart was human any more. He had been turned into a bird. Was he still the wart? He was an animal now. Could he die? He might die. He might. And it was that possibility that held me spellbound every time I read the scene. I felt an apprehensive terror that was just big enough to master. I'd read on, desperate to reach the end, for that moment when the wart springs up from the perch, the goshawk's great foot clutching at his wing before he wrenches himself free and survives. I knew nothing of ordeals, but reading it felt like one. Every time I finished reading it, part of me was relieved that I'd survived to read it again. White had escaped the school by running to the woods, but he'd rented a cottage on the old road to its door. He'd gained freedom by changing his life, but he'd not escaped the concept of freedom that school had given him. At school, you move up from year to year, gaining more power and privilege until finally you leave. It was this notion of freedom, as the natural end to an ordeal-filled education, that never left White. And it was working within him when he lengthened Goss's leash with breakable twine. As a schoolboy, he knew that the boys over whom he'd had authority would one day have authority themselves. As a schoolmaster, too. And a falconer. Deep down, he knew he was always training his charges for a time when they would be free. Chapter 25. Magical Places. 10 days have passed, Last night the forecast was bad. A storm surge threatened to inundate East Anglia. All night I kept waking, listening to the rain, fearing for the caravans along the coast, their frail silver backs against the rain and rising seas. But the storm surge held back at the brink, and the morning dawn